Peter Rapp. He's feeling a little bit under the weather, but as a good AA champ, he showed up. And I give you Peter. Thank you.
My name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Yeah. This is my Barry White voice for tonight. Turn down the lights.
We could do that.
I remember those days. I was the only white guy in the neighborhood who thought I was Barry White. A couple of drinks, I was anyone. I'm Peter, recovered alcoholic, grateful to be alive and sober, part of a sick, good place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Glad to be here. And God separated me from alcohol on June 23rd, 1988. Because of God and the 12 steps and a sponsor and this wonderful gift of desperation, I'm still here and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I say this every time I get to a podium, I say recovered because I am. And anything less than that would be falsely humble. I was away at a conference not too long ago, and they asked me to sit in on a panel. It was way north of New York. And someone asked about this word called recovered and recovering and what's the difference. And it sounded like a newcomer's question, and that's fine. They didn't know the difference. And one woman on the panel leaped up to the microphone and said, with multiple years of sobriety, by the way, I never want to be recovered. I always want to be recovering. Because if I'm recovered, I don't have a reason to come back, and I'm always working on stuff, and I'm always going to have stuff to work on. I said, what a sad commentary for not only how recovery, both Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went on and on, and what really was interesting was a bunch of folks in the crowd were doing nodding, yeah, she's right. And I had an opportunity about three or four questions later to kind of answer a question that loosely paralleled the first question. And explain what recovered meant. And some folks think recovered means cured, and it's not cured. It recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, recovered from the obsession, obviously recovered from the compulsion because of a spiritual awakening. And what's great about that is the behaviors that will accompany alcoholism while we're not drinking, we get recovered from that as well, whether it be sex, food, money, gambling, fear, anger, whatever it might be. The chatter of a thousand voices that go on in our head all the time, even though we're sitting in an AA meeting. Usually when I do a talk, I figure half the room is thinking about what they're going to say since they get an opportunity to share, or the traffic back, or tomorrow morning at work. And that's just the nature of the beast. That's how we tend to operate. And then we have a portion of some members in AA who are completely present and awake to the breath they're taking. Because they are awake. We are awake and not sound asleep thinking we're awake. And that is truly the goal after we separate from alcohol. And the separation from alcohol doesn't come because I want it. I wanted to be separated from alcohol for many years, but I kept going back to that, which is killing me. And in six out of the seven treatment centers, the seventh one, I'm still here. But in in six treatment centers, I managed 2 days of total sobriety. And I had powerful desires not to drink. And so I landed in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1988, and my first, I would say about 6 months in AA, I looked like a drunk without a drink in me. We sober up a horse thief, we still have a horse thief. And although they removed the symptom of this great problem, thank you so much, we still have the problem. And the idea is not just to know the steps, but to do the steps so I can have a vital spiritual transformation necessary for permanent recovery. And this is where some of our AA can get a little bit funky, and we split the room in half because we have the hardliners who say, don't drink and go to meetings and don't worry about the steps, and bless their heart. You can pull that off. And if I had the power to not drink, why would I have to come to an AA meeting? I'd stay home. In fact, if I had that kind of power, my life would be joyous, happy, and free all the time. If self-confidence and self-esteem and knowing my issues and my triggers and having enough money and having the perfect relationship and having the perfect house, and it goes on and on ad infinitum, if all those things were in place and I stay away from a drink and joyous, happy, and free, why am I sitting in an AA meeting? I don't need to be here then. But if I'm one of those folks who lived a life of dishonesty, incapable of being honest with myself and others, and I hit rock bottom, only to have another rock bottom, there was no place to go but to surrender to a God, even though I had problems with God, even though God at the time, even when I approached my third step, was this thing that wasn't really this power, that wasn't tangible. I couldn't wrap my arms around this power called God. I had lots of skepticism and doubt about God. God took Mom. Mom prayed to God for years, and she still took her life. I was touched inappropriately by someone for a couple of years. Where was God then? I used a lot of worldly clamors, externally as well as within me, the clamors within me, to separate me from God. But whatever I was doing was still landing me in another treatment center, in another jail cell, with another drink in me. And so I got to that jumping off place when I approached Alcoholics Anonymous, and I surrender in step one. It was made abundantly clear to me. Is this a raid? What's going on here?
So many people can't hear you.
Oh, I thought it was a hit. I wasn't sure. Jewish guys do that too, right? They're not here. Right. Okay, keep talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. You know what?
I feel important when I come here. They're always jacking up the volume. That's this is going to be a 30-week thing. Thank you, anyway. Thank you. So I surrender to step one, and it's really interesting. I've said this a bunch of times. I can't tell you how many folks go through treatment centers or just come to Alcoholics Anonymous and are sitting in a chair in an AA meeting, or do 30, 60, 90 days in a treatment center, even go to a halfway house after that, do all the things they're asked to do in treatment centers, and then come to AA and sit in an AA chair, get a treatment, halfway house, or and/or AA, and they're getting chips, and they don't know what they suffer from. They can tell you, I can't stop drinking, but they can't tell you why. They can't tell you why they keep returning that back to that which is killing them. They can't tell you why they're still acting like a drunk without a drink in them, why their behavior is inappropriate at all times, why their thinking is out of control, why they're still fear-based and insecure going in AA. They don't know why. So I can point fingers at lots of folks, but when they get to AA, they shouldn't have to wonder what suffers from them anymore. That's our job. And I feel really blessed because some of the folks I met along the way in treatment centers and in AA meetings, one meeting in particular, Three Legacies meeting in Minnesota, made it abundantly clear to me what I suffered from. Now, experientially, I knew what I had, but I couldn't articulate the way the book says, and I had to learn how to get an education. So the dots connected. Oh, that's why when I started, I knew I couldn't stop, and even when I didn't want to, I kept going back. It's called a phenomenon called craving and an obsession. And even with the most powerful desire, I'm going to drink. Step one says I'm drinking. I got that part. So what's the solution? They said God. And here's where I kind of bristle at antagonism, as many of us do. I haven't met many folks who come in today and say, God, how great, sign me up. In fact, a lot of folks who come into AA, not all, but a lot of folks who come into our meeting and say, yes, I believe in the Lord, they don't. It just sounds good. And my God, your God, knows we doubt him. Of course we do, from time to time. Even with multiple years of sobriety, we may get to a fork in the road and say, okay, God, you abandoned me again. I've done it. I've done it many times in sobriety. When I was near bankruptcy, when I went through a divorce, when I couldn't get a job, I couldn't get arrested at one point in my life. Bank account was empty. I'm trying to get a job, hitting the pavement. I can't get anything done. Nothing's working out. It's okay, God, you abandoned me again. Is that what's going on? Are you testing me? No. What I had to do was surrender so he can say, here's the road. Here's what's paved. Growth doesn't occur until we walk into the unknown where I've never been before. But God is waiting at the door, and I keep banging on this door saying, you abandoned me, and he says, no, turn this way, here I am. We put a ladder up against the wall, we climb to the top, and he says, that's the wall you're supposed to be going up, not that one. And we quickly blame folks. So when I got to step three, when they told me there's this solution pointer in step two, I get to step three, and they're asking me to turn everything over to this power called God. I had no choice in the matter but to surrender, but I did it with one eye open and one eye closed. Like, where are we going with this? And I remember the third step prayer with my sponsor. We kneeled down and we did the third step prayer together, and which was a little different for me, but we did it. I had nothing to lose. I was told for years by my first sponsor, call God out. And I tell men that when I sponsor them. I tell the guys where I work, call God out. Call him out. We would do it in a bar. You go after someone. If you knew someone begged, a little street education, when you heard someone was looking for you, you went looking for them. It was the street code. Right? You didn't hide out. Call God out. Go look for him. What I have found out is God is begging for a relationship with every one of us. God's pursuing me. God's pursuing you. And we say, tomorrow I got things to do. And I say, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes and I got more things to do. And God says, okay, I'll wait. I'll keep waiting. But I'm here. And God's pursuing me this with the same energy I pursued a drink. Because he doesn't want to lose any of us. And unfortunately he does. Because we refuse to surrender. Because we still have a little bit of self-reliance left in the tank is the killer. A little bit of dishonesty left in the tank, it's a killer. A little self-confidence, a little bit of self left in the tank. And if there's a little bit of self left in the tank, I will not surrender truly to God, the good and the bad, which is what they're asking me to do. Is God everything or nothing? They asked me in chapter 2 agnostics. And we say everything because it's the right answer. But do we really mean everything? Everything means everything. And I think I talked about this last week. Including the things I love, the things that give me joy and pleasure. It's everything. Has to go to God. I'm willing to surrender all my money, all my possessions, all my relationships, my children, my home, everything I think I am. And I find out my mind takes life way too seriously. My mind is way too fearful. Because nothing is really that important. And I'll even go on to the edge, and I've obviously not experienced this, but where I am right now, even when I get called home, it's not that serious. My humanness is, I'm not ready to die yet. Why not? Where am I going? To a bad neighborhood? And what we do when we walk around here, we die to self. And we feel like we're literally dying. And we are. We're experiencing the death of self before the physical death. All necessary information going into step 3 when I turn my will and life over to care of this power called God. Because he really thinks you mean it. And am I willing to say that my life is none of my business anymore? When I got done with the third step prayer, my sponsor said, great. Your life is no longer any of your business. And he meant it. I'm not in charge of my relationships. I'm not in charge of my money. I'm not in charge of anything. I mean, I make effort. We make efforts, but we're not in the results business. Who I'm supposed to date, where I'm supposed to live, what I'm supposed to do for a living, what I'm supposed to drive, how much money I'm supposed to make is none of my business. My mind has at is business. Oh, we're supposed to make this much, live here, date this one, go here and do that. How's that working for me so far? Not too good. I need a drink to live on life's terms. That's why I never tell anyone, live life on life's terms. How can I? Life on life's terms is life on Peter Marinelli's terms, which means I need to have all this to feel okay. Most of us, I'm one of them, walked around with my mind-dominated life and looking at life through a delusional set of eyes. Perceptions and conceptions that were not right. They were skewed. They were off base. They were fear-based and insecure. Is that my bartender? I'm like right in the middle of something. We need to get clear. We need to wake up. We need to experience truth in order for me to see with God's eyes, speak God's words, hear what God's ears, and be like God, be a direct reflection of this power called God. Now, those raising the bar really high, but why not? And we start with a decision in 3. And I've heard many times folks say, work a really good step. You need a really good step. Don't go anywhere. Just stay on step 3. Learn how to turn it over. I turn it over. I take my will back. Sounds really impressive, but none of it's true. Like I'm a God bigger than God. Like I can turn my will over to God and then say, I'm going to take it back and pull it out of his hands. Like I'm a God bigger than God. Whose will was it in the first place? God. And he gave it to me to play with. But God knew he had a bunch of egomaniacs called alcoholics. And I don't call alcoholics. He says, you know what? I'll pretend it's their will so they think they're really giving it back to me. Because you know at some point we think we're bigger than God. Like when I try to keep a secret, God won't know. Right? Right. When we go to do our taxes, God's not involved in that meeting. Okay. So my book says how it works. I've heard many people say, I don't know how it works, but I know it does, and I want to scream, go to page 58. I don't know how it works, but I know it does. It's on page 58. How it works. That's what it's called, how it works. How what works. Right? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, we read this at a million meetings. Do we know what it's telling us? It's the setup for step three, coming out of step two, that we have this pointed to a solution, that this power is going to restore me to wholeness of mind. And the only way I'm going to experience this wholeness of mind or sanity is through the death of self, where illusions, delusions, perceptions, and conceptions of my past have to die. And what I'm left with, I'm standing in the raw in front of God, with nothing, stripped down to nothing. And I'm convinced at that point that none of the external conditions will ever remedy the internal condition. Only God could and would if he was sought. Am I seeking? Am I willing to seek God? And all we need in this work is a mustard seed of willingness, just willingness. And many times I was one of them. I would see the old timers convinced about God. Sure, God was working in their life. I said, I'll never get there. And our chapter to agnostic says, I wish I can believe as that man believes. We're all in the same pool of water. I'm a lifeguard, you're a novice, but we're in the same water. You will become a lifeguard too. And I would see the old timers speak so sure of God. I said, I can never get this. He said, yes, you will. Are you willing? Yes, then off we go. And that's all that's required here through this whole process of work is willingness. With a mustard seed of willingness, we can move a mountain. We're sitting in an AA meeting. The mountain's been moved. Now we have a pick and shovel, and we need to just do some searching, some digging. That's not that hard. The mind creates a difficult task. The mind creates, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And what gets in the way is the way. The 12 steps is the path, and that gets in the way. We're begging for a solution. Someone says the 12 steps, and the mind shuts it down and says, all of that work? No, it's easier chasing a bag of dope or a drink with no money. That's fun. Right? What gets in the way is the way. And one of the things I was talking about on Thursday night, the truth is true until we find out it no longer isn't. And many of us have to bottom out in sobriety all while we're out there to find out my truth is no longer true. There's only one truth, and that's God. Whatever your God is, but God is God. And we'll take different donkeys up to the top of the hill, but we're getting to the same place at the end of the day. That's why our book says we don't want to be warring theologians. We don't want to be warring AAs either. We're praying to the same power. It just wears a different hat for some of us. Who cares? Is it all love and no opposite? Yes or no? It's a yes or no answer. My God, all love and no opposite? But do I have... I know you have God, but I got God. Right? Rarely have we seen a person fail. Fail at what? God consciousness. Fail at what? Sobriety. Fail at what? Getting recovered. Who's thoroughly followed our path? Not my path. Not your program. I don't work my program. You ever hear that? I work my program. This is a dangerous consideration. Those who do not recover, people cannot, will not completely give themselves to a simple program. Big Book says most good ideas are simple. A simple program. We have professionals who can talk about what we suffer from, can break down the chemistry in the body, and what happens to the brain chemical. They have all these charts and graphs about that. And they'll say, listen, you have something that once you start drinking, you can't stop, and here's why, charts and graphs. And you have this obsession of the mind, for some reason it keeps taking you back to that which is killing you. And that's all they can tell you. Then we come into AA, and we tell you how to get the obsession removed. And once the obsession is removed, the behavior has now changed. And unless a professional is in AA, their hands are tied. Carl Jung and Dr. Silke were big enough to say, this is what you need, we're not really sure how to do this. But we come into AA and we say, we know how to do this. You have obsession, compulsion, you need God. Here's what we do. And somehow, at some point, some way, the obsession to use, the obsession for me to kill myself, because that's what I'm doing, is removed. It's kind of plucked out and replaced with God. And suddenly, the more God I have, the less mind I need, and my behavior is proper. I have the proper attitude when I walk out and face life on God's terms now. Everything has changed. We've done that 180. Those who do not recover, people cannot or will not completely give themselves to a simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates, they're not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. We know those folks. They just keep in and out of AA forever. We throw everything at them and they insist on doing it their way. And they die drunk. They die wet brain. I don't know why. Constitutionally incapable of getting this. There was a point, I think, for many of us, the relapses in here, where we were just that type. My second, third, fourth, fifth treatment center, they would throw everything at me and says, I know what I need to do, right? The mantra to our graveyard, I know what I need to do this time. I know what I need to do. I get it. I get guys calling me up from all over. They want to talk to me about some of their struggles. And then I give them information, and suddenly they're getting off the phone with me. Because they won't hear the truth. It says they were naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Am I a man or a woman who lives with rigorous honesty? Rigorous honesty. That's not on my terms. Honesty is honesty. And if I'm dishonest in one area, I'm dishonest in every area of my life. If I have a little bit of cancer, I have cancer. If I'm a little dishonest, I'm dishonest. But the ego says, well, it's just a little dishonest and no one knows about it. And what happens is the spiritual progress starts to get sick again. It starts to erode the progress. And it just sits there. And sometimes it lays dormant and then it starts up again. If I'm dishonest, I'm dishonest. My book says demands rigorous honesty. It's not a suggestion. I was at a meeting the other night and we were throwing around suggestion like, do it if you want. You don't have to. Don't worry about the steps. Don't worry about God. When did this happen? There are a set of clear-cut, precise, specific, exact directions on how to get better. And if, God forbid, one of us had a terminal illness and the doctor says, I'm going to tell you specifically how to get cured, we'd follow it specifically. And we come into AA, there's suggestions, don't worry about it. Even from sponsors. I suggest that you go home and call Mary. Instead of go home and call Mary, those are the rules. And make amends. My sponsor never suggested. He hollered. Their chances are less than average. There are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. We all have grave emotional and mental disorders. It's the mind that takes me back to drinking. I keep going back to that which is killing me. It's a grave emotional and mental disorders. I don't need a psych issue for that. I have a big enough one. I'm an alcoholic. With a mind that's running my life into the ground. But I have the capacity to be honest. I have the capacity to be filled with God. Honesty, truth, God. All interchangeable words. The container that you see here has the capacity to be filled with God. At one time it was full of poison. It was polluted. And it just piled on spirit. And I can never be in touch with this power called God. It's the emptying out. The process of recovery is subtraction. It's removal. It's never addition. We don't need anything to get well. What we need to do is remove stuff. Remove the lies to experience the truth. Remove the delusions to experience the truth. Remove the illusions to experience the truth. Where we're left with nothing. And then the nothingness is great. And the nothingness is more. I'm a musician when I for years. And I remember music producers would always say, in less, there's more in the music. Don't, if anyone, musicians know, you don't overplay. You need space. It gets bigger. Same thing in this process. Less is more. Less of me, more God. More me, less God. Right? the ABCs tell me that I'm an alcoholic, cannot manage my own life. This is all moving into step three, my considerations. I'm an alcoholic, cannot manage my own life, drunk or sober. And the belief system is once I'm sober a little bit, I can now manage my life. I'm in charge. After all, look at me. I'm a star. I got 20-something years. I speak around. I have a job. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I'm in a nice relationship. You know, oh, look, I can run my life now. And as soon as I do that, I don't need God. Here comes fear. If self-confidence and self-reliance worked, I would never experience fear and I would no longer need God. Remove something from that equation that gives me self-confidence and self-esteem and self-reliance. I'm down on my knees again. God is God. I'm either in or out. Can't be a little bit in and a little bit out. I'm all in or I'm not. God is everything or nothing. So I'm an alcoholic, drunk or sober, and cannot manage my own life. The other consideration is that probably no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. I've experimented with the probably, by the way. That she would work, the money would work, the job would work, and I kept getting drunk. No human power can relieve me of my alcoholism, drunk or sober. Because even though I'm sober making meetings, I don't care how long we're sober, we still suffer from alcoholism. The old timers would say it's not alcoholism, alcoholism, it's here. I'm not cured. I need to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness and continue to seek this power with the desperation of a drowning man or woman. God could, and what if he was sought? Am I seeking? What do my actions tell me, not my words? What am I doing to seek God? And the book is really clear. Just follow what we have in front of you. Directions, not suggestions. It says, being convinced we're at step three, we didn't take step three yet, we decide to turn our will and life, my thinking and my actions over to God. And here's where the ego steps right in. You mean everything? All my actions? You mean I can't have a little playtime? That's up to God. Am I willing to surrender to this or not? And my grand sponsor would always tell us, sure you can. You do whatever you want. How's that been working for you so far? The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, to walk into AA. We hear that all the time. Third tradition. Only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, not to get recovered. To get recovered, there are many requirements, the things we need to do, things we get to do in order to get recovered. And it says, being convinced, we're at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will and life over to God. The first requirement, that I need to be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Experientially, I can tell you that's true. Based on everything I did on my way into AA, my first 6 months in AA, my life was run on self-will, and it was not successful. It didn't feel successful. It certainly didn't look successful. I was still bankrupt, and I was thirsty many days, and the pain of being sober like that was so great, it was either drink and die or surrender to God. I made another surrender, and that was just grace. We get grace no matter what we've done. It's just a gift from God for being one of his children. And I quickly found out that we're the physical extensions of that power which is not physical. And many times I should have been drunk during those first 6 months and I kept getting another day. What I learned from that lesson is when we get those 60 days, when we get our 90 days, it's a wonderful thing. It doesn't mean I'm much better. I'm just marking time on a calendar. 90 days, how many people I'm sponsoring, how many amends did I make now? Well, I'm just counting days, or I'm making days count. Where am I with this? Because alcoholism doesn't really care about my blue and green and red chip and my coins. It really doesn't care. It's take 90 days. I'll get you on the way home. What am I doing to get well? What am I doing to experience the abundance of God? And our book brings it right point to point. And so what I did was I look at the third step prayer, and I wrote it out word for word. And I wrote down my interpretation of the third step prayer. What was this telling me? God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. This is different language, so I had to understand what this book was telling me in my language, so I can internalize this. It becomes my prayer. Otherwise, it's just words on a page. What's really great about this, our book is really interested in our willingness and our intent, including the third step. If I never heard the third step prayer before in my entire life, and I hit my knees one day and says, God, I'm done running my life. Can you please take over? And the intent was pure. It's just as good as a third step prayer. The intent is pure, and that's what counts. But we have a beautiful prayer. And after I did it with my sponsor, He says, your life's none of your business, and our book says next we launched out in the course of vigorous action. I didn't make 90 meetings in 90 days and wait. I didn't work a good third step before I was ready for my fourth step. The way we do step three is by doing 4 through 9. It's pen to paper. Because as soon as I'm done with my third step, my book says, next, we launched out in the course of vigorous action. The first step is which a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. I've been taking inventory, your inventory, forever. I've been taking everyone's inventory. My book says, no, it's a personal one now. We're going to take a look at what's going on within me. What an order, I can't go through with it. But the road has already been paved. And when the rubble is cleared, I can see the road very clearly. I don't have to invent a road. The process of recovery is removal, constant removal, and I get to see the road right in front of me, that my God brought me to this earth, my God got me sober so I can walk this path. But it's been covered with many things. It's been covered in relationships and lust and greed and anger and drama and all the seven deadly sins. It's just been covered. Regrets, resentments, can't see it, expectations, it all has to be removed, and I can see the golden path God has laid out for me and the path laid out for you, so we don't collide anymore. One of the great things that happened when we clear up is we're not in collision with other people the way we used to be when we were untreated. And our book talks about that in step three. My life without self-will can hardly be a success. That I'm always in collision with something or someone all the time. And if no one's around, I got stuff going on in my head that I'm in collision again. If they only did this, if they didn't do that, and it goes on and on and on, and I'm never free. I can never sit back and go, everything's okay. Thank you, God. So I need to go back through my life. Do a searching, fearless, and moral inventory. Now what's interesting is it's not back to my first drink. It's back to a life as far back as God allows me to remember. And I get to look at resentments, a fear inventory, principles, institutions, and a sex inventory. And over and over and over again, we will get to see how the mind was in charge of our life. And it was fear-based and insecure, and we were never right. How we were playing God, how I was playing God in every area of my life. And even times when it got really bad and I was feeling despair, you know, despair, what that feels like, it's awful. It's an extreme form of self. That's all. When I'm in a place of despair, I'm consumed with me. Regardless of the circumstances that brought me there, I'm consumed with me. And I don't become very teachable because I want to bring you into my despair and just sit with me. Let me unload on you day after day after day. But if you come at me with a hardline solution, I'm going to chase you out because I enjoy my despair. It's drama. It's all about me at this moment. It's all produced from a thinking mind which loves despair. The ego can wrap its arms around that and cradle it and protect it and nourish it. What God wants me in despair? I thought my God wants me to be joyous, happy, and free. Despair is an extreme form of self, and I get to see that. Angry with people because they didn't do what I wanted them to do. 30 years ago, I'm still nursing this grudge. You know, here I am, maybe 40 years old, writing inventory, and I'm writing stuff that happened to me in elementary school about Joe the bully who beat me up. I'm 40 years old. I'm still afraid of Joe, and I'm still angry about it. And the thing with resentments and fear, everything we see, the way we speak, and the way we act, all comes from that unresolved stuff. I can never be present if I'm driven by voices from the past. How can I move forward, when I'm still listening to voices of the past? So step four allows me to put that on paper. And I get to see how I'm just as damaged as the people I've been pointing fingers at. There's a great line. It's something like, before I take the speck out of your eye, let me remove the beam from mine. But for years I've been pointing at everyone's fault. And my fourth step says, even though people were partly to blame, I can't do that anymore. So I make this master list of names, and it started with mom and went right back through my life, all the way through high school, all the way through elementary school, all the way to kindergarten, as far back as I can remember, with relatives and friends and things, names pop. Now, what we need to do, what I needed to do, was write a prayer across the top of the page. Thank you, God, for allowing me to be searching, fearless, and moral. Because if I don't turn to this power, remember my third step, and all things are possible with God, how could I, on my own power, be searching, fearless, and moral? I'll cut corners, I'll be a little deceitful, and I won't write as much as God has. God has a warehouse of information for me, and I get tired and say, the heck with it, that's enough. But God knows we have very wide shoulders and can carry a lot of weight. This is where the rubber hits the road over and over and over again in this work, and here's where it happens again. Because we can all do a third step prayer and sound really gung-ho about it, but when the sponsor says a notepad and a pen, now go write your life, not life story, not an autobiography, but all your life, all your innermost secrets on paper, we balk. I don't know, is that serious?
Yeah.
Right? And so I started to write after I made prayer. I would make prayer, get silent, and write in the pen. I was talking about this the other night. The pen becomes a spiritual translator. The pen is moving. It's in my hand, and God's leading the pen. Because when you do an inventory, you know things are going to flow off the pen that you completely forgot about. You didn't think were possible. Things are starting to come back. You can almost smell what's going on. When you're going back 20 years, and you can almost feel what was going on. That's all God stuff. That's that intuitiveness. And we're pushing, and we're pushing, and we're pushing. And God is revealing himself on paper. But I'm thinking I'm Moses. I got to part the seas to experience God. Right now it's happening. God's pushing your pen to be searching, fearless, and moral. This is just as big as Moses parting the water. What drunk is rigorously honest on paper for someone else to read? I mean, that's what we're doing. Tell me your innermost secrets. Put them on paper. And you're going to share it with me when you're done. Great. Where do I sign up? I mean, we just don't do that. And so many times, you know, I was one of those, what's a miracle? When Moses parts the sea. You know, when he comes down from the heavens, taps her on the head, that's the miracle I'm looking for. And I go right past the fact of, I didn't drink today, miracle. I'm not drunk today, I'm supposed to be, miracle. I'm writing the searching field of some moral, miracle. Joe relapse that has 90 days, miracle. I start to recognize miracles right in front of me. Our book says the age of miracles is still with us. And we will get those big things that will happen. We say, oh my God, indeed, the miraculous. And then we get to a point on this path when we see this miracle. I don't want to say matter of fact about it, but we're kind of like, well, what else did you expect from God but a miracle? Of course Joe's sober 90 days. Of course I pushed through with my fourth step. Of course that newcomer with 30 days is already in amends. Of course. This is what God does. The great healer. And if your God is not a healer, maybe you should trade it in and get a new one. If your God's not a healer, if your God's not capable of doing great things like this, guess who your God is? Look in the mirror. That's your God. All things are possible with this power. We just need to experience a little bit of it. And if you speak to anyone on this path, something gets ignited along the path, and suddenly the doors open and you say, all things are possible with God. I can't believe I have 6 months without a drink, and I completed my inventory. How did this happen? Impossible. And then you listen to some folks who've been around AA a while, and they say, you see that guy over there? See that young lady over there? You don't know what happened to them. They came in here, and boom, they lit up. I was new, fairly new, and I was sitting in a meeting 1:30 afternoon in Brooklyn, in Marine Park, Brooklyn, and it was an anniversary, and I was sitting with Harry. He was a real old timer. He used to always have me sit next to him, and he said, I want you to listen to this woman's going to speak today. And she got up to the podium, and he says, watch this. Well, this woman got up to the podium, and she was as elegant as they come. She was articulate, incredible. She told her story, and she got beaten up by alcohol so bad, she walked the streets to earn money. And beaten up by those people. She had a horrible, horrible, horrible time. Lost her children, divorced, obviously, and was in the streets and doing things like that, selling her body. And then she bottomed out and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was a train wreck. I never forget her talking about this. Well, she sobered up, got a sponsor, went through this book. Things started to change. She went back to school. And she kept staying in school and working. Little by slowly, she started to get her kids back again. And she was a big deal, a partner in a law firm. She was now an attorney. And she looked like a rich attorney. How did that happen? Makes no sense to the mind, but in the God's world, it makes perfect sense. And she had a stable full of girls that were right there. Those were her girls. And no one was going to get near them either. None of the wolves in AA. Because she knew what men are capable of. Unbelievable story. And I was so glad old man Harry said, watch this. Because I listened. What is she going to do? And there it was. So we clear out the path. And I remember sitting down to write inventory. And I made this master list. And some mechanics, resentment, the person we're angry with. Next to that, the cause, why we're angry with that person. Then we have a third column called the effects mind. Seven areas of self that we put down that are hurt, interfered, or threatened. And then we put down, rubber hits the road again, where I'm at fault. So even though you ripped me off and you did something bad to me, I was involved in your drive-by and I'm writing this inventory, I have to disregard what you did to me entirely and take a look at my part, rubber hits the road, because it's so easy to say, well, of course I beat him up, look what he did to me. Of course I gossiped about him. He's been gossiping about me. Unacceptable. No resentments are acceptable or unacceptable. Have to find my part, and perhaps I've just been hating you forever. That's where I'm at fault. Anger is selfish. Anger insists that I am right. Anger insists that I am right and that you are wrong. And it's a blockade to God. Anger gets in the way of any kind of reconciliation, any kind of healing, any kind of oneness with God. But we hold on to our anger, the justified resentments, because they did this to me. What lengths am I willing to go to? I start to see my delusional world I was living in when I look at the first three columns as well. Because the names change, the players change, but I'm the same in column 2 and column 3 and column 4. It's me over and over and over again. The first three columns are really all based on a lie, based on my misperceptions and conceptions about life. I'm delusional. I'm sound asleep trying to go through life awake. I'm trying to make good decisions on who to be with, good decisions on jobs, good decisions on financial sanity, good decisions, but I'm sound asleep. I'm living in a world of delusion because my mind's in charge and it's fear-based and insecure. And I land in AA, a drunken bum, and I can't figure out why I can't do life. I lost my compass. I have no GPS, and I'm trying to figure it out on my own. It's okay, let's look at the mess. The reason why there's no amen at the end of the third step prayer is because I have to go in with God. It's a body of work, and God's going to navigate me through this room of rubble. Because if I went in without God, I wouldn't. I'd probably go in just a little bit, pull a couple of chairs out, and go home. Or I wouldn't even open up the door. I need to go in with God. And so I list all my resentments in my four-column inventory. And I'm done with that. I look at fears. The evil and corroding thread. It says the fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Really great illustration. You ever have a pull on your shirt, and you keep pulling, and by the time you get done, you got a tank top? Right? Right? The fabric is shot, done. There's nothing left. You got a handkerchief. Right? That's what fear does. And because I have fear, it doesn't mean I don't have a relationship with God, but at that moment, I don't. At that moment, I push God out in a sense. Doesn't mean I don't have a relationship with God. What I do, I turn back to God. Thank you, God, for courage, strength, and direction, because I have some fear. But I get to look at all my fears. And some of the fears are very real. Some are fear of dying, fear of having no money, fear of poor health. And for me, it was always like, because I'll be vulnerable. I'll be humbled by that if I got sick and needed people. If I died, looking at death was always the most vulnerable you can be. You can't do anything about it. You're powerless over it. Having no money, you're vulnerable, you're humble. That scared me to death. I had to address those fears because no matter what I was doing, that was always lurking. No money, oh my God, I'm going to die. A relationship ends, oh my God, I'm all alone. No one else wants me, oh my God, I'm going to die. You know? I'm going to die someday, oh my God, I'm going to die. And I get to see my self-reliance in all areas of my life. It permeates everything I do. Everything. There's just holes in the armor, and I can't escape me wherever I go. And so I take a look at this fear inventory. I had fear of dying, fear of poor health, fear of my dad dying, because my mom had died already. I was fearful of my dad dying. Lots of stuff. And I was talking to Marion about this the other day. Here's some of the things that would walk with me. I'm 28, I'm writing inventory, and all this came to life. A lot of us can identify with abandonment issues, right? I lost my mom when I was 14. You don't lose mom at 14. The most important person in your life is mom for the guys. Mom goes. And I remember one time, my dad, when he was going, went back to work, he would wake us up every morning, and wake me up every morning, because I had two younger brothers, and give me a peck on the cheek and say, Dad's going to work. Your grandmother will be up in a few minutes and get you guys ready for school. Every morning. And I remember, if I didn't hear him, I used to get really scared. No one's in the house. This is after my mom died. Well, one morning I woke up and I heard my dad's car in the driveway. And he drove away. And I remember I was about, 15. And I'm banging on the window for my dad to come back because I was alone in the house again. That's the aftershock of having your mom commit suicide and that raw abandonment that was untreated. 15. This is where I am with fear. And then I go down to play stickball with my friends and I was in charge again. But what was underneath that, I was 8 years old and scared to death. I was 5 years old about, and I had to go for get my tonsils removed. This all came out on inventory. All this stuff I had neatly tucked away. And my mom and dad took me to the hospital, and I'm in this crib. And mom and dad are there, and I'm a little nervous, but as long as mom and dad are here, they tell me the doctor's going to come in, and you're going to get a big toy after this is all over, and they're trying to, like, sugarcoat the whole thing. And the nurse, Ratchet, told my parents, she was about 6'12", 350 pounds. She had arms like this, but she had a skirt on. I still don't know what that was about. But she told my parents it's time to leave. And my mom gave me a kiss, and my dad gave me a kiss. And they were leaving, and I went into panic. And I'm a little guy, about 5, and I'm screaming to my parents, don't leave, you know, mom, dad. And my dad wasn't sure what to do. My mom started, remember, she was crying. They were coming back in, and a nurse held them back. And what they did was they threw a net over the crib. Like, I looked like a fisherman's net, because I was trying to crawl out. And Nurse Ratchet came with a syringe about this big. And that's the last thing I remember. And I woke up, it was early in the morning, and there was a nurse standing by my door, by my bed. And I woke up, and she says, you know what that red is on your pillow? She says, that's your blood. And I remember laying in bed and I was scared to death, like as if Frankenstein was standing next to my bed. And that's the last thing I remember. Now, I'm 5. All of that's unacceptable. Right? Some loony folks in this hospital. My mom at this hospital, I think it was in Brooklyn. And then you go about your business, and you go about your day, and 5 becomes 10, and 10 becomes 15, and 15 becomes 25, but that's unresolved. That kind of terror, that kind of abandonment, that kind of my parents left me, will now take effect in my relationships with women. It will take effect in my relationships with men. It will take effect in my job and how I perform my job. It will take effect when I'm just hanging out on the corner, getting drunk with the guys. That is the cancer. It's the pain body that an author talks about that needs to get resolved. And it would never get resolved until I got to step 4. And God says, remember this, and I'm putting it down, resentment towards mom and dad. Believe me, resentment towards the dirt nurses and the doctors for doing that to me, throwing a net over me. And it goes on and on and on. And I look at the fear of being alone, fear of being left somewhere. I remember growing up and so many of my dreams, I remember talking about this in therapy, so many of my dreams, they're almost like repeated. I was left in this on a mountaintop. This is just what happened regularly. Left on a mountaintop, these dark skies, ominous warning. Dark clouds over me, left on a mountain, and there is no one. I used to wake up out of my sleep screaming, this was a problem. This was a problem. And I was always waiting for something to get me. Something or someone was going to remove. If I was in a relationship with someone or things were kind of going okay, Bill says the goose hung high, I knew at some point, somehow, some way, somebody's going to pull it out from under me. It happens. It has to happen. All unresolved stuff. Could not see that until I hit step four. And then God said, well, here is the ground's fertile. It's time for you to get free. Here it is. Now, you can't talk about that stuff over a drink in the bar. It's wimpy. But when I share that in an AA meeting, everybody goes, yeah, I got one too. I know exactly what you're talking about. A little different circumstance, different place, but I know what that's like. That's why our book says we know loneliness as few do. Whether we were 5 or 55, we got it. We own it. And we drink about that. In order for me to be present, that stuff has to be fixed. It has to be uncovered, discovered, and then discarded with the hands of God. I'm not afraid of being alone. Now, that doesn't sound like much to some folks. That is my miracle. I'm not afraid of being alone. And somehow, God puts someone in my life when that ground is fertile and the relationship is healthy, because I'm not afraid of being alone. I can be a better partner. I can be honest. I can show anger. I can show fear. I can show intimacy. I'm not worried, oh my God, if I do this, you're going to run away. This is me. Here I am. What freedom. My boss knows me. We talk. We talk about a lot of things. Here's what's going on. I'm not afraid of being alone. That is my age of miracle coming to light, all because of this work. What's really interesting, when I sat down with my sponsor in 5 and I would share these things that I thought he would say, wow, what kind of man are you? You're kind of wimpy. He had the same stuff. Different players, different circumstances, same stuff. We all got the same stuff. We're not unique. But it's got to go. I've walked around polluted long enough. And that's why I love doing the steps at least once a year. To remove more, remove more, remove more. God will reveal and it gets removed. Shows up, we push it away. And then perhaps one day I'll stand completely clear. And that's probably the day God calls me home. I don't know. But I'm chopping wood and carrying water. That's all I got. Peace.